The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, Space Show listeners. Welcome to the Friday Morning Space Show. Thanks for tuning in, and we're going to have a terrific discussion and program. One of our very favorite guests is back with us, and I'll introduce you and tell you a little bit about Tim Pickens in just a minute. For those of you who would like to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Let it ring until it can be answered, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And in addition, I will hold you over a break. So if we're coming up on a break, don't let that stop you from making the phone call. Email is drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. A lot of you always say, "Why do you have 3 email addresses?" Well, it's because they always don't work at the same time. Gmail goes down from time to time. Exchange server, which is Dr. Space, goes down more than time to time. And Yahoo is pretty stable and is sort of the last-ditch way to keep in touch with everybody. So that's why I have 3 email addresses. The main one is Dr. Space, and then the other two we check from time to time during the program. And then chat is on AOL's IMICQ and CompuServe programs. And the screen name is the same for all 3 of those, lowercase, one word, space, show, chat. It is visible, up and running right now, but if I'm not in your buddy list, you won't see it. So space, show, chat should get into your buddy list, type it in or add it or ping me on it. And I'll reply right away, and then you'll automatically be in the buddy list. Remember that we're trademarked and copyrighted. You can download shows, copy them, send them around to your buddies, your friends, your family. The only restrictions are you can't do anything commercial with it. And please don't edit these shows and don't put them on YouTube channels and things like that. And in addition, if you want a quote or a reference from the shows, you're welcome to do that. Please use a full academic citation. If you don't know how to do that for an electronic media show, just send me a note and I'll send you the format on all the different style forms, so you will know how to do that. We are podcasting with gigadial.net. The RSS URL is on our website, both of our newsletters, iTunes compatible, search for The Space Show or my name, Podcast Alley, Astrospace Now, a whole bunch of other places, including Y-Astro, WIASTRO.com. If you have any problems with the podcast, let me hear from you, okay? And then our website is thespaceshow.com, so the comprehensive newsletter gets uploaded Sunday evening, California time, no later than Monday morning, California time. It has all of the details of the week's programming. It has the full guest bios, and it has the future events section, and it is where you will see changes to our weekly programming or important announcements first. So do check the website newsletter from time to time. You can't miss it. Just scroll down our website about a quarter of the way down, and you'll see it in the center of the page. Everything we do is archived right on our website going back to 2001. You can easily download the shows right off of our website, or you can listen right off of our website. We have a store that we advertise on our website. Check it out. It's called Space Show Gear. And, of course, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. We can't do this show without your support, and we really do need it, especially in this economic climate. And we thank you for those of you who do support us, and we hope more and more of you will. Remember also that you can now comment post material that you think is supplementary, and you can even rate Space Show programs, as this show and all Space Show programs are now being uploaded and archived on the new Space Show blog called http://thespaceshowoutsidethebox.blogspot.com. So have at it as you see to it, okay? And then what do we have? We got hold the dates. There are a couple of dates that you should know about. They're all pretty far away next month, but you've got the International Symposium for Personal and Commercial Spaceflight in Las Cruces, New Mexico, October 19th, 20th, and 21st, unless you stay over for the runway dedication at Spaceport America. Get all their information at ispcs.com or listen to this week's Monday program that we had with Dr. Pat Hines. Commercial and Government Responsive Access to Space Technology Exchange, or CRAST, C-R-A-S-T-E, October 25th through the 28th at Moffett Field, California, which is Mountain View, and it's really NASA Ames. Their website, usasymposium.com/CRAST. Puerto Rican Space Conference and Auction, October 23rd through the 27th. Their website, leeward.crowdvine.com. It's at the Sheraton Puerto Rico Convention Hotel and Casino in San Juan. And then the Space Studies Institute has the Space Manufacturing 14 Critical Technologies for Space Settlement by the Space Studies Institute. This one is at the NASA Ames Conference Center in Mountain View, October 30th through 31st. Check it out at the Space Studies Institute website, http://ssi.org. And then the last one I'm talking about is the Japan-U.S. Science, Technology, and Space Applications Program Symposium, November 14th through the 18th. And this is at the Fairmont Orchid Hotel, Kuala Coast, Island of Hawaii. Their website is http://JUSTSAP.org/2010. And if anybody is attending all of these, first of all, I'd sure like to own the airline that you're going to be flying on. But I'd like to know how you do it, because this is going to be a lot of travel during the month of October, flowing into November. And then remember, we're brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit the Secure World Foundation's website at secureworldfoundation.org. And finally, I get to introduce Tim Pickens to you, again, one of our favorite of all-time guest on the Space Show. Tim is now the Chief Propulsion Engineer and Commercial Space Advisor for Dynetics. He frequently speaks at really cool, high-profile, and outstanding space conferences. And Dynetics purchased his company, Orion, in December 2009. This is actually the first time Tim has been on the show since he sold Orion. Tim, most of you may know, probably is the guy that should get all the credit, but he won't do that, for developing the Spaceship One propulsion system and engine that helped them win the XPRIZE back in 2004. He also is now part of a Google Lunar XPRIZE team. We'll talk about that, too. And rather than continuing to read about Tim Pickens, let's talk to him. Hi, Tim. Welcome back. How are you?
Thanks, Dave. I'm doing great. I appreciate the introduction. It was overwhelming.
Well, I mean, it's only a fraction of your accomplishments.
No, it was good.
None of it's hyperbole or BS or anything. So.
It's been a lot of people have helped along the way to do all the stuff we're doing and you know, have done and will do. So it's good to be a representative here to talk about some of those things that, you know, we've done together. So I appreciate you having me on.
How does it feel to no longer be self-employed and to work for another corporation?
I'm liking it. It took a little getting used to in the first couple of months, because you had a tendency to still want to get involved in everything. You want to fix all the little problems you're used to running around and helping with, and the organization, we restructured everything in such a way where that just wasn't the need for me to to do that, and they wanted me to be able to think, be looking over the horizon for new opportunities and be able to think about the next invention, the next propulsion system, or the next, you know, gadget that we need to go develop for the commercial guys, or maybe even the DOD or whoever needed it. So I don't know. It took me a while to morph into to really enjoying what I'm doing. I saw some people at the conference recently, and they had come up and said, you know, Tim, you look a lot younger. You know, you look a lot more relaxed. Last time I saw you, you looked like you were just really stressed, and when that would have been last year. And running a business, and as it growed, it really it got more uncomfortable, you know. And even though there was a lot of fun here and there, but as a person who's on the hook with the bank and you know, and having to work with those guys to keep good cash flow going and letting them know we're meeting milestones and things like that, and they get into every element of that, it pulls you in places that you don't really want to go if you really like to bend metal and design stuff. So it becomes not fun at sometimes. So, and the more it grows, the more of those little things that tug you, and they occupy more of your time. So I've gotten away from that. I've got to get back to dreaming. I've got to get back to doing the fun stuff.
Well, you know, people should understand that not always in business, even when you own your own business or you're self-employed, that everything you do is fun. I mean, you know, that's not necessarily an entitlement by being in business, is it?
No, it's not. It's, in fact, you know, and people also, you know, I think a lot of companies, they don't get very far down the road because of a couple things. You know, they focus on the technical things that they like to do, and they'll go out and win one or two programs. Then they'll bore in on that because that's the fun stuff. And then the wheels will fall off the business because no one's out there looking for the next opportunity. And then once that's over with, which is a lot of fun for everybody, then it's like, what's next? And that happens a lot. So, and we're not all cut out to be managers. And we need to know that. But a lot of people have a hard time letting go. And they think that you know, without their control, that it's you know, the wheels are going to fall off of it, and it's just not true always, you know. And I felt like I tried to bring in the right kind of people that had proven themselves, so I didn't have to feel like I had to micromanage. But still, at the end of the day, you are working with the bankers, and you are on the hook financially to meet milestones and to do things, but that's a good thing. You know, that's a real good thing, David, because it keeps your product quality up. It keeps you meeting your deadlines, and it keeps the process lean. You know.
Yeah, I wish members of Congress were listening to this right now to understand the need for outcomes, performance, and milestones and accountability. But we won't go down there. So what are you doing new? I mean, I know you got a Google Lunar X Time X Prize team going, but you got a lot of other stuff
that
happening.
That within itself is a huge deal, by the way. You may not think. I think anyone who's seriously doing this, a Google team, has got a tremendous amount of work to do. That within itself, if you're serious about it, is a full-time job for a few people now. So just working the business case and working, you know, some of the sponsorship opportunities. The fact is, you know, we've just jumped into this, but, you know, a year ago I was looking at this, and I thought, wow, that's just what I need to do, jump in another fun thing to do and go off on a tangent with little old Ryan that doesn't have the resources to probably do this like it needs to be done. So I didn't do it. We talked about it. So over here at Dynetics, we had a lot more reach. We had a lot more capability to do these things. So we, teaming with Draper and Teledyne Brown, that was a big deal. And then our governor pledged $1 million at our event the other day when we had a press event, when we rolled out our team.
Tell us about your team, and let's talk about this for a few minutes.
Okay. Yeah, we've got Draper Laboratories, and those guys are really good guidance guys. You know, they've cut their teeth in the DOD world and been going. Those guys have been around for 50 years. Their heritage goes back designing, guidance back in the Apollo days. Anyways, they also they've been working the M guidance algorithms for the NASA M project. We got you got guys like Teledyne Brown here in Huntsville. They're a big company. They actually did all the roll thruster systems, the big hypergolic thruster systems for 1X. All that flight hardware that was done by Dynetics. I mean, not Dynetics, but done by Teledyne. Also, what was done by Teledyne was a lot of space hardware relating to the space station. They built a lot of stuff. And so they've got a heritage that goes way back. They've also been building the structures for the lander work that NASA's been working on, all the flying gas lander. Now we're doing a warm gas lander, peroxide lander. So all that work, well, we've learned a lot about flying landers.
What is the name of your team?
Our team is the Rocket City Space Pioneers.
Okay. Who else is in there? Let's go through who your other partners
Andrews,
are.
Andrews Space. So you got Jason Andrews. And Andrews has an agreement with SpaceX to broker slots on the Falcon 9, and that's a very key piece of our arrangement. We are flying as a secondary payload on an ESPA ring, okay? And
uh-huh.
We're selling the other slots, so that makes our business model close. So we're flying on a Falcon 9, and we're selling the other six slots. The primary payload and the other five slots on the ESPA ring. And the ESPA ring has been modified to have auxiliary propulsion. So we actually leave the Earth orbit using propulsion from the ESPA ring after we drop off three payloads. So it's kind of a unique way to do this and pay for it, make the business case close.
Now you're talking Falcon 9 or Falcon 9 Heavy?
This is we're flying Falcon 9. We're doing basically the 3,600 kilograms and a geosynchronous transfer orbit.
Do you have a timeline?
It's going to be the 2013-2014. So we weren't going to be able to hit that. Our business models will not include the $20 million win. It expires in the 2012. It'll go down to 15.
Do you think anyone?
If the very worst came to worst, we'd do a little better than break even for our mission if we happen to miss that window for that year. So we're still good. So it's a different way of doing this, but we had to come up with a good business case, so we weren't going to go and do this at all.
So what if all you're going to do is at best break even or close to that?
No, that would be if we didn't hit it till 2014.
Okay. What is the future for the business? I don't know if you can say this, it may be proprietary, for the business model beyond winning the X Prize.
Okay. I'm not going to get into that too much, but I will say that, clearly the we always have to have good science reasons to do these things, and there have to be precursor. You have to understand this is all part of some precursor work to do some other work, like Mars-type work, and do other things. But it's also, you know, the fact that NASA out here, you know, in a currently kind of position to go buy data for missions like this, certain types of image data and whatnot, that's a critical piece of this. And I think they will, if you can, you know, our mission, you know, these missions are not cheap. You know, these are $90 million missions to go out here and do a mission like this, you know.
Uh-huh.
This is not cheap, but it's still lower cost than anybody out there who would put anything down the surface of the moon and be able to do some science. So it's a real smoking deal for any science organization who needs to do some research, you know. So we've actually identified several opportunities, which I won't talk about here today, but yeah, we had to have a sustainable plan that would carry us out quite a ways. But I will tell you this, the nice thing about between the prize and as well as some procurements on the street, the nice thing about the cycle right now is that it will actually allow you to recur your investment to go and do this, and actually help the development cost, which is a big deal. So, and it's going to open up a lot of venues once you get through that. So I will leave it at that.
And you've got, what, about 15 teams now participating in this?
Well, there's 27 teams now.
27.
the last few weeks, I think there were a few letters of intent submitted, which allows you to basically say, hey, we are going to be a team, maybe. So then you can cycle those. You can cycle those through about every 3 months, I think, and resubmit it. Basically, it says, hey, we've submitted an application saying we are going to be a team. And the price to do that is not much. It might be $1,000. So what we did is, we were fully committed to this, and the X Prize was very committed to working with teams that were committed. So we went ahead and paid in full. And we are fully registered because we wanted to show our commitment to going forward.
Do you feel the competition from other teams?
No, not at this point. We've actually worked with a team or two supporting a little bit of propulsion. You know, people that wanted to get some quotes on propulsion systems and things like that, but you know, we firewalled these things, and we're just excited to be part of this race. We independent of there being a competition, we're not sweating it. It makes it exciting, but we gotta get moving. You know, we're a latecomer in this, and we're not delusional about that. So we might surprise you with some of the stuff that we're going to be doing and flying probably sooner than later if everything clicks like we hope.
Well, you may be a latecomer to Google Lunar X Prize, but probably in terms of propulsion knowledge, experience, and having had successful stuff done, you're probably at the top of the whole basket of the 27. So.
Well, I appreciate it. If that's true, we got to keep our reputation strong. We'll have to try and produce now.
That's right. So, what are some of the other projects that you're now undertaking, and how do you occupy your time at Dianetics?
Okay. Well, you know, we've got this M&M's rocket that we've developed, this multi-purpose nano launcher system, and that we recently did a full-up booster test at the Army, and it was actually one of the test stands. They originally did testing of the it was the Redstone that ended up lofting Explorer 1. So we ended up, from now, of course, the Army did the Explorer 1, and then, of course, you know, the Jupiter. And then, of course, there was the big rift between the Air Force and the Army, as there was with the UAVs and other venues. But the Army has a real need for soldiers to get data and imagery down to the soldier in the field. So basically the Army's gone out here, once again, after 50 years, it's kind of taken matters into their own hands in the name of being responsive to the warfighter, and they're basically doing little microsats, and basically they've built quite a few of them, and some of these guys weigh about 20 pounds apiece, and part of that is they went out and developed with us. We led the development of a rocket launcher, and that's this thing called M&Ms that can throw one of these satellites into LEO, about a 220-mile orbit, and we can do it for a little over $1 million. That's been the target price. That's something we've been trying to do for the last 2 years.
How portable is the launcher? Does it launch from the warfighter in the field?
Yeah, it's a platform, containerized type system. And that was the intent, to be able to cycle through. Just basically, there was a requirement of a 24-hour call-up. Once the soldier calls up and says, hey, we need to look at this location over the hill, and this is what we're looking for, then there would be they'd pull a satellite off the shelf and dock it with the rocket, and they'd do a launch within a 24-hour period. And this would be treated, the difference is this would be such a cheap system, and then the satellites are this way too. The satellites are, they're running anywhere from, they're just a few hundred thousand dollars a piece. So if you've got a rocket that's, you know, certainly under $1.5 million and a satellite that's under, so let's just say it's a $2 million package. Now you're talking cruise missile prices. So you start looking at launch a little different. And certainly, if it's in wartime, you wouldn't have to, you know, you'd have certain the range constraints are certainly a little easier, and the range is going to be a big issue that we are going to continue to wrestle with, the range cost at the traditional ranges, by the way. So that's another piece of this that we're all working.
What's the life expectancy of one of these satellites?
You know, they're designed to, you know, this is more about months, not years. This is really about a very dynamic kind of a, I think they actually designed these things to, actually, the life was actually years, as I recall. We're not involved in the satellite side of it. But some of these orbits that they're looking at us doing would have, the decay would be such that, they would be, you know, an order of months. But that's the thing, too. You know, the cost is such that, the size is such that it's just a different way of looking at responsive space, you know?
Is there a name for this? Like, could we Google an Army website or something and see a picture of it?
Yeah, in fact, there was a big article on this M&Ms just the other day. Let me see if I can pull up a reference to it. Let's see right quick. There was a big, nice article here in the Huntsville Times, actually. And it was talking about the Army retaking back, getting into orbit cheaply. And that was a Huntsville article in the Huntsville Times. So you could go to al.com and search getting into orbit cheaply. And that's
okay.
All about the Army having to go back after 50 years and get back in the launch business in the name of getting capability to the soldier.
So they're launched from Huntsville.
No, they wouldn't be launched from Huntsville. This would be guys out. It might be, you know, we've been doing notional launches from everywhere from Quad to you might launch in a battlefield situation where you're, these things could be launched where you might be looking at something over North Korea or whatever the case might be. There's been different launch scenarios that we've looked at, but no, nothing would ever be launched.
So when I was in Huntsville a couple of years ago and I toured Marshall and the Redstone Arsenal, and they showed me the back then defunct but historical, all the test ranges that they used in the early days of rockety and stuff like that. So they've brought some of those test stands and things back to life?
Yeah. There's some of the test stands down on the Army side. They use them. I mean, they just depends on the program. You remember, after many years, the main Saturn V test stand at the Marshall side, they ended up testing the big RD-180 out there.
Uh-huh.
And that was a big deal for Huntsville, because they invited the public out to those firings. And there might have been six or seven, I forget, but I went to many of them as I had known about.
Do you have a security clearance?
Yeah.
Just curious. I'm not going to ask you about it. I just wondered if you had...
We're all various levels, but in this business, it's not uncommon here in Huntsville for to have various...
You're at gossip level 3, right? Tim, let's take our first break, okay? And I've got a couple of questions that are piling up from listeners on all sorts of different subjects and some of your history. So when we come back, we'll hit some of the questions and then keep going with some of your new activities, all right? So everybody stay where you are. We'll be back with Tim Pickens in about 2.5 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Friday Morning Space Show. And our guest today, Tim Pickens with Dianetics. Tim, this first email question, and by the way, listeners, you can use the toll-free line. It is a talk show. It's not called an email show or a chat show. But the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. This is from Anthony, who is on the other side of the Atlantic in the U.K., and he says, I assume the wheels didn't fall off of that Porsche you beat up all those years ago. That must have been a milestone. Can you remember what model it was? Thank you. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here. if you could, so what was, I just caught a piece of that. Sorry about that. I was having an interruption here.
Okay, I'll reread it. It's very short. Let me just read it. It's a very short note. This is from Anthony in England. He says, I assume the wheels didn't fall off that Porsche you beat up all those years ago. There must have been a milestone. Can you remember what model it was?
Oh, goodness, a Porsche. Is this a metaphor, or is that one of the literal Porsches that I might have owned?
No, I don't think it's a metaphor. I mean, I think he's really wanting to identify the Porsche.
Oh, goodness.
That you beat all those years ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, the only Porsche I remember beating was maybe in a Volkswagen I hopped up. but that was a 1.6 liter to a 2.2 liter and did a little bit of racing that could have compromised my license at the time of my younger stupid years. Now, but no, I don't know that is relevant or not, but oh goodness. You know, I don't know how to answer that.
All right. Well, we'll leave it, and we'll do this one. This is from John Schubert. John says a number of manufacturing jobs and companies have left the United States. Do you have any problems finding materials for your projects that are no longer made in this country? For example, do you have to look outside the United States to find any metals, rubbers, composites, electronics, or tooling to build or test your motor? I listened to one of your prior shows when he spoke about how he'd bring job seekers down to the shop floor and quiz them on whether or not they recognize certain machine tools. Does Tim worry that since many or most schools have eliminated wood, metal, and auto shop, that high school or college grads today have no idea how anything works and do not have the ability to build anything?
Right. Well, it certainly concerns me. You know, when one of your biggest high schools in our area with over 2,200 kids, when they're, you know, one of their premier classes out there for, you know, the quote, the tech school level class would be culinary and woodworking. And when my wife would tell me, you know, they don't do real work, where's the metal work and the welding, and I said, yeah, we're gonna have a hard time going to space with wood and just a bag of chips or even a little piece of cake or whatever they've made up for the day there in the culinary class. Yesterday I was out at the tech school center of technology here in Huntsville. And those guys here in Huntsville have been, the last few years, have been winning the moon buggy races. Up till last year, they had beat out MIT and all the big colleges. Now, these guys are just hardworking guys. They have the weld shop. They've got the machine shop. You got the paint shop. But these guys are at the high school level. The shop teachers are just smart. I'd call them country boys that just know how to get things done. One of them was a motocross guy for years, and I'll tell you, the suspension on that thing was incredible. And I'm telling you, for them guys to tell me that they have whooped these big name schools for the last few years is pretty impressive. But what it told me was, they're able to probably do a decent design, cycle through enough changes and make tweaks quick enough before probably the big guys or the major institutions get the thing off the drawing board. And that's kind of, in a way, we were that way at Orion. I was a big fan of very versatile architecture and approaching problems with respect to whether we were designing a motor or whatever we were doing, because I knew at the end of the day it wasn't going to be exactly what we thought the first round out of the box, because even though I've got really smart guys and we all crank the equations, there's always variability. It usually happens in the machine shop. It usually happens in material finishes, the hole tolerancing, and all these things, they stack up, they bite you, and they end up pushing the design a little off its off the mean. So I was a big fan of keeping things versatile, so we could always turn the knobs. because we could do, if we hurry up and crank the design out, we'd build it because of the capability we put in place and the type of people we hired that really weren't afraid of bending metal. And even if we melted metal, we were going to recover fast enough that, heck, we'd have three or four iterations before the traditional system would even be done with the design.
So, can you do the same at Dianetics? Does it move as quickly?
Yeah, I mean it's a different world, but you know, you've got a company here that has traditionally been heavy in the engineering. They're very, very, very good at analysis and problem solving, working, the foreign threats, the various pieces. You know, they even did the MOAB here. They did it in 3 months, by the way. All that tail can, the grid can, the guidance and control for that, and even that whole big bomb shell that they, you know, they pack all the munitions in. They did all that here in 3 months. So they can do these things. But it is a different world. There is process and procurement cycles that do take a little time, but we are also bringing our own philosophy here that of what really worked good for us, and they're listening, and we are changing the culture here and in our own way, and change is never comfortable, but we are being embraced, and Dave King was here to start the space business, and you know, he's the vice president here, and he is committed to that. And I mean, think about it. Here you've got a former NASA administrator, not administrator, but a center director for Marshall, is now here for a year and a half, and we've committed money. He's actually brought into being a new satellite here called FastSat. They put millions of dollars of IRAD into that to develop their own bus and class of satellite, and they built it right here.
Got a show on that in a couple of weeks.
Oh, okay, cool.
But I don't know who's on. Kimberly from Marshall has arranged it for me.
Okay.
I've got two people coming up on the show, but I don't know which two she wants to have on for me.
Well, NASA was an awesome partner. You know, the bus technology, we got from NASA. All this testing we did with NASA, a lot of that, I mean, it was a big program. Well, we did it in 9 months. So it's setting up at Kodiak right now, getting ready for launch.
Yeah, I she's been sending me information about it. It's an amazing program.
So that's the kind of stuff that Dianetics wants to do. So if you're seeing a rocket engine and a flying platform and a new missile to launch small satellites, and you're seeing satellites, you know, we'd love to, you know, we want to, ultimately, we'd like to be able to offer on a small scale and kind of an end-to-end solution for the guy who needs data. We don't want him to have to worry about all the in between, you know. He needs information. He needs it tomorrow. We'd like to make all that transparent and seamless, all behind the scenes, you know. So that's our goal. But we also want to run, I'd like to run as much of a Kelly Johnson model here as we can in terms of operations. So we do. We bend and break, you know, we're having to break some stuff here to do that. And by the way, Dianetics, in the last 7-8 months, we've developed like 6 new rocket engines and test fired them and built them here in our shop. So they're all over this stuff. So
yeah, what are the markets for those 6 new rocket engines?
Oh, part of them are, we got the hot gas lunar lander work we're doing, NASA. We've got some storable monoprop work where it replaces hydrazine. It's a propellant called 315. It's put out by the Air Force. It's a new hydrazine replacement. It's a higher performance, but green hydrazine. We built one of those. We've got the M&M's big rocket engine we've tested, and we've developed a new 10-pound thrust hydrogen oxygen engine that could be used for everything from fuel depots to larger maneuvering systems for spacecraft, like Bigelow or whoever we might need something like that. So those are things we've developed in the last eight months.
What about the first part of John Schubert's question? Are you finding that you need to go outside the United States more and more for materials and components, and in terms of your being able to hire people that know how to do things and build things, is there a shortage of hiring competent, qualified people, or are the layoffs now putting a lot of people on the market? What about those two aspects?
Well, it's so far we've been okay on the material side for the types of projects. As a rule, we try to design things that don't require the really exotic materials, but there are cases where, you know, you've got to go for high performance. And if you need titanium, it's expensive. And we, you know, we get a lot of that from Russia. We don't personally, but suppliers do. And you know, if you're needing the platinums and the iridiums, all the rare metals and things for some of these combustion devices and things, the price is expensive. And we've never gone abroad to have to get any of this stuff personally, but it does drive the few vendors you have, it drives the cost up. You know, I'm convinced we wouldn't even have availability for a couple of these. You know, we would have a hard time having access to some vendors if it wasn't for the fact that I think that's where our protectionism through ITAR is a valuable thing. The ITAR does keep an industrial base, force us to keep an industrial base to cover our strategic interest in this nation. And it's expensive, and it doesn't allow us as much of as many options, but it does offer us guarantees.
Well, I keep reading that the administration is really hell bent in pushing total reform on ITAR, especially in the space related fields. It is a real thin balance, I know, to reform this and to open up commercial markets for a lot of this stuff, but to maintain exactly what you're talking about, the national security and the strategic balance. I'm glad it's not my job to do it, but it is a real thin line to do this appropriately and properly.
Well, I agree. And recently I mentioned that at a talk, I said, you know, it's questionable, even though we have it's wonderful what SpaceX has been able to do, and it's bringing the cost models down and really disrupting the launch industry for the U.S. But it's questionable and they've been able to do that working out of L.A. Very expensive state, California. You know, it's going broke.
Yeah, well, tell me,
you know,
it is
building
broke.
Rockets right there in the middle of downtown, so it's which is incredible that they're able to do that and transport them across the United States and launch them and make money. It's a testimony to his operation and his business model, and I'm very impressed. But it's also I think without ITAR in a world climate, in a true international open market, if ITAR didn't exist, I don't know that he would even be able to compete.
No, he might be making his rockets in China.
Exactly.
I mean,
seriously.
I mean,
there is there is it's a two-edged sword. It's protectionism a little bit, but in this case, there is some value from a strategic interest for our nation. There is some value there, and it's a hard thing to compromise and give up, because it is the ability to put assets up for our nation, to put assets on orbit and do other things is so critical. And we don't need to have to rely on other nations to do that.
And I agree with you on SpaceX. I don't know if California is the most expensive labor market in the country. If it's not the most, it's got to be within the top two or three. Now, I do know he's in Hawthorne, which is lower cost than where he located in downtown San Francisco, for example. Mm-hmm. But these people are still paying California income tax, California benefits, California mandates, and all the other crap that this state puts on businesses and still thinks that they're a business-friendly state. Mm-hmm. And he is able to disrupt the pricing models for the aerospace industry in the United States. So you're absolutely right. It is a testament to his business skills and to his systems that he has been able to implement to do this in a state like this and ship it across the country, paying attention, as they've said, to antiquated infrastructure, which means you have to manufacture things to go through tunnels and bridges that never were designed for anything like a modern-day rocket.
Right.
So
on that note, I think it's also fair to say then, if you were to do, then there is a market, there is a potential there for someone to still come in with a business model and produce launch systems and make money in a place other than California, and doing it in such a way that takes advantage of certain labor markets and as well as logistics to still offer some real affordable solutions. And
Therein
lies the opportunity, David, and that's something I just like to point out to people sometimes who think that, you know, this is the end all. I don't think it is.
No, if you got a low business cost state, you've got air, rail, truck, and water transportation, like some of these inland areas in Oklahoma, Arkansas, and these other places where you can use barge traffic to go, you know, pretty far within the country. You've got a lot of room to do things that others don't do if you implement and don't have to live with legacy structure and systems that drive your cost way up.
Right.
Really interesting. Here's another question. Bob in San Diego, California. And again, listeners, use the damn toll-free line. Come on. It's not an email show. 1-866-687-7223. I actually have a goal this year of getting listeners to use the line much more than email. Anyway, Bob in San Diego says, what does Dynetics have planned for space in the future? Are they getting involved in the commercial space aspect of all of this per the new space policy discussions? What do they see for the future? And I'm a little bit confused. If you're doing things for lunar lander motors and other related products, I thought that these programs were canceled from NASA because we're no longer going to the moon. So how come there is still work being done on projects that will probably never be used?
Well, that's a good question. Well, one thing's for sure, nothing seems to ever be final, and we still have a House version, we still have a Senate version, and you know what? We have to have a business model that assumes one thing, that there will be a certain level of science that will be done on the moon by various research institutions. And there will be other markets per the Futron study of 2009. There will be reasons to go to the moon, and there will be precursor reasons to do it to prove other systems are ready to do other missions. So I wouldn't put all my eggs in today's space policy as it might appear today? Because that swings. It seems to swing back and forth, and lately it's been swinging back and forth between every administration, and that's why we don't have a launch system yet. But we are, I'm a big fan of a heavy launch capability for the nation, and the question is, is the government going to truly lead that effort, and are we going to let others do it? And those are policies that I'm not involved in, but I do think we've got to make sure the nation we're not without a capability, and I'm a big fan of putting our eggs in a couple of baskets, right now. We're in a big stalemate, and it's a real unfortunate. We got unemployment hitting 10% in some places, and even higher.
Higher in Nevada and California.
And we got a lot of good talent, and we got a real vacuum of technical areas right now, we need to, if you believe in and stimulation through money till you get the economy back on track. And I'm not an economist, but if those are your techniques, then I think technology and space is as good a place as any to go and try those things. I am a big fan of getting a couple of things moving on a couple fronts. I'm a big commercial guy, and I want to see commercial space succeed. But I also want to hedge our bets a little bit, and I'd love to see a big heavy lift vehicle too. And if the agency, if NASA's leading that, then that's fine. But we need to get it done, and if there's not enough money for both stages of the development right now, then let's focus on what stage could be completed with the budget, so we at least meet a milestone and get something accomplished after the architecture's done and all the trades and whatnot. I'm saying let's meet some milestones and let's go fly something. Otherwise, we'll just end up in this paper study world, and we'll have a boat without a rudder.
Go ahead.
Right now, we are at a place, if we don't get some decisions made with respect to budgets, we are certainly could very well be seeing budget cuts, and we the space community, we don't need that either. So we've got to get this behind us and to get out here and do what we can with what we end up with, and I hope commercial folks, so we get a good piece of this, so we can continue to do some of these cool programs that NASA's starting to reach out and let us do that we've never got to do before.
How do you define heavy lift? What are the capacities?
Well, I'm thinking, this 120, 130, 30 ton. Lift capacity is, obviously the lack of defined missions that we'd like to do ultimately is still a little fuzzy too. But if you go back to the days of the Apollo and you think about what we had, you think you would at least like to be in that range of capabilities and do something a little more, wouldn't you, David?
I would, but I see a lot of discussion that heavy lift at 70 metric tons would be just fine. You're talking more than twice that or twice that.
Well, that's because people are playing with the idea of fuel depots and all kind of ideas.
Doing tons of programs on that lately. Yeah,
everybody's wanting to do docking and transferring of propellants, and rendezvous and all these complicated things that they do add a level of complexity to the missions. You know, the original rocket team, there were no dummies that I mean, they weren't crazy to make the decisions to have the lunar module and they have all the pieces right there together. So they ended up in the same orbit, same location, and all they would have to do is separate and do rotation to do a dock. It really helped simplify the operations to do a mission to the moon. And even though it was a massive rocket, but it certainly simplified operations. And there are some benefits of that, obviously. But I think fuel depots, the idea of them, it's a pretty neat idea, but it's just more stuff that we're going to have to go learn to do that we haven't done yet. And every time we go learn to do stuff, it just takes time, and it's just longer we don't have a capability because we're dinking around. You with me?
Yeah, I happen to agree with you, and the guys that I've had doing these fuel depot discussions, most of the pros I've had on are more or less saying what you say, although possibly from a little bit of a different perspective. But the listeners and the space enthusiast community, this is the new true believer cause that is starting to rival space solar power causes. So it's a real popular topic on the show, and everybody's designing orbits for where they know the depot can work. And they've all got it boiled down to the really simple thing, so we don't even need heavy lift rockets.
Well, and David, it's a great fallback position, by the way, if we don't get the budgets to do the other. Okay, it's kind of a compromise, in my opinion, too, because if you don't get the budgets to go do a big heavy the way you'd like to do it, the way we know that it's worked in the past, then what else can you do? Then you have to figure out, how do I get the Delta V to get us out of orbit with a heavy payload to go do X mission? Well, I mean, those are the kind of things you get creative, and those are the kind of things you have to go do. So it's not a bad idea. I'm not dissing the idea. I'm just saying it does make things more complicated, but it does help fit the budget, and it still can do some pretty serious missions. So I'm not saying it's a bad idea, but it's just not. I don't think if you had the money and you could pick either or, I'm convinced that Von Braun would have done the heavy.
Let's take another break, and we'll come back with our third segment with Tim Pickens. Everybody stay right where you are.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. when this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, listeners. This is the Friday Morning Space Show. Our guest today, Tim Pickens with Dynetics. And Tim, your lead-off question for this segment, by the way, listeners, again, the toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223, is Kent in Seattle. And Ken said, given your track record with the Spaceship One engine, are you doing any consulting with Sierra Nevada on the Spaceship Two engine?
Nope. I'm not doing any of that. I saw those guys recently at IAA conference in Nashville. I saw actually Jeff, Frank Macklin, and some of the original guys I worked with. I think they're having enough fun without me. But you know, that's the first round that when I was working out there, and you know, I ended up working front end of that. We ended up doing a lot of design work on the front end, just sketching and brainstorming before I ever went to work out there and at scale. And I actually met Bert in 99 here when he was talking about getting bored with airplanes. He was in no way funded and later go to work. But so we ended up visiting Space Dev then, and I was still not an employee. Bert and I flew down there, and they actually didn't want to let me in. So they thought I was the evil enemy, I think, because I'd been working on a little company on the side called Hark, and they were a hybrid company too, and it was kind of funny. But I ended up saying, hey, no, I'm just helping Bert. And it wasn't too much longer after that he hired me full-time. And we actually, and I told him about Corey Klein down in Miami with EAC, that we ought to look at those guys too. And you may not know it, there was actually another company in there called HMX, which was Ben McKean, Gary Hudson. And they bidded on that. So basically at one point, and there was one... A lot of people don't know this, but there was one more possibility of a company that was going to do that engine. And that was the one where they would send Tim Pickens back home to Huntsville. And he would design and lead the engine from Huntsville as a competitor.
Who was that?
And that would have been, basically, it could have been with the Hart team, which was the Greg Allison's company. And you know Greg, right?
Yeah, very well. Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, anyways, it's a real interesting scenario. So Greg and those guys bidded on this thing. So we had four companies bidding, and their plan was they were going to hire me. And so Bert, it's kind of funny because I think they kind of got into this, scaled, and said, wow, you know, this is, you know, is Doug Shane and those guys says, wow, you know, we don't really build rocket engines, and we got Pickens here, and, you know, this is, yeah, we could, you know, I'm like, well, you know, we can do this in-house, 100%. And it was just, it was like them building their own Lycoming engine, you know?
Uh-huh.
They don't normally build airplane engines. They buy them. So, but they hired me as to lead propulsion. And possibly design, develop an in-house engine. And that was what it said on my letter of you know, of hiring, if you will. So,
right.
I don't know if you want to hear this story, but it's kind of interesting if you got a sec.
Yeah, sure.
But what ended up happening is, so there at the very end, we kind of put the three other companies, HMX, EAC, and Space Dev, on hold because Hark was bidding, and I wasn't involved in that, but I those guys bidded, and Steve Mistakis was their chief engineer, and Hark was a spin out of kind of the Halo guys from the NSS chapter in Huntsville, HAL 5. Anyways, did some balloon and rocket stuff. So it was really an interesting time. So who ended up getting it was the primary work was EAC and Space Dev. Well, it's kind of funny because Corey and those guys, they had done some pretty neat hybrid work up to date. They had fired a 1,500, maybe up to 3,000 pound thrust Hyperion, and we were needing, you know, obviously something in excess of pretty big. You know, in excess of 12,000 pound thrust sea level. And then there was in Space Dev, they had primarily done, you know, small engines, probably nothing any bigger than a couple hundred pound thrust. Basically, you know, about what I had on my rocket bike. And so but they had all the patents for the AMROC. So they had all this data, but they didn't really have all the people there. So it was a really interesting scenario. But they did have a lot of other projects going. So they had a good management. They had some good technical people. So this was all... Yeah, so they ended up getting the work. Plus, they were not far down the road from scaled. So EAC was the other guys. So we ended up developing the architecture of what it looked like. That's the motor mounted to the tank. That's what Bert and I came up with. There'd be a valve located in the bulkhead and those sorts of things. We designed the nozzles in-house. We did the RCS system in-house. We did the motor cases in-house, and we'd send those out to have the fuel put in them down at EAC and Space Dev. So those were all the things we did. We did our own nitrous blowdown models, and we reviewed, or I did, all the testing and pre-test reviews of anything they were going to put on our test stand that we designed in-house to test everything that they would bring back, which was our motor cases and our own composite tank. So that was the relationship. So Tim didn't design everything. It was a very big team effort, but it was clunky. It was like herding cats. And I'll leave it at that. And of course, you know, now they're back there doing the second round, because I think Scaled's just busy, very busy, and they have very capable people to do these sorts of things down there at Scale. But I think they had their unfortunate accident there. They just got overwhelmed, and it just seemed like a natural default to go back to folks who had won the competition to get there to do the final spaceship work there that we did.
Can you scale up a hybrid motor pretty far, or is there going to be a limit to what you can do with it?
Well, to be in my opinion, they're difficult beast to manage as you scale them up. A hybrid is a very forgiving engine. If at a small scale, because, you know, typically we're not cooling the combustion chamber. We're protecting it with the fuel grain. It's done right. You got a good ablative wall and nozzle that's built right. You know, the injector for like a nitrous oxide system can be very simple. So you don't have a fuel and an oxidizer mixture component to it that's extremely I'm not going to say complicated, but it's a very forgiving combustion process, probably more so than most engines on a small scale. But it's also driven by what we call, you know, the rate of combustion and is a function of the, you know, it's M dot, but it's also, we refer to it as a flux based, kind of a, situation where the more mass flow you have of the oxidizer, the more erosion you have of the fuel and the mixing, and that's how you can control the thrust. But there's a point you hit where your flame will actually run down the grain and it can't stay attached to the fuel grain, so it could actually flame out. In other words, if you overflowed the oxidizer, it would actually flame the motor out. You could push it right out the back end. So you are bound by certain physics that drive you to a certain diameter and fuel grain length, okay?
Uh-huh.
To get the oxidizer fuel mixture ratio for a given oxidizer. So you have a certain amount of grain surface area that you have to have for a given flow rate of oxidizer. Is this making sense?
Yeah.
So what you got to do is, so that requires, and obviously for a glider, you need a very, you don't want the center of gravity shifting very much. Okay? The reason is, you've got to stay control of that thing. So you don't want, ideally you don't want propellants, and you don't want long, skinny tanks or motor or fuel grains that would shift the center of gravity and alter your ability to control the aircraft. You don't want to come back aft center of gravity heavy, right?
Correct.
Okay. So the point is, as you get shorter and fatter motors, that requires you, which means you're trying to reduce the center of gravity shift. That requires you doing creative things like doing multiple ports in the fuel grain to get the surface area back up. Okay?
Okay.
In other words, you can get it with a long skinny pipe, or you can do many short pipes, okay, to get the same surface area. So basically what happens is the mechanical properties of fuel are limited. So to support holding that fuel grain out there and to do that reliably is not trivial at the larger scales. Now, on a solid motor, rocket motor, you're not producing a high-speed flow field past the grain. In this case, your oxidizer is rushing past the fuel grain because you're trying to literally erode the fuel grain. And some of that is through radiated heating and some of it's physically eroding, okay?
Gotcha.
So what you're doing is you're literally trying to drag the fuel grain out the back end. You with me? You got an injector on one end. You're flowing nitrous. So the mechanical properties of a fuel grain are very important on a hybrid. Do you remember when Mike Mevel flew and he said that on the Jay Leno that he said it felt like at some point he had a big bang, it felt like a hammer hitting him in the back?
Right.
Well, what he's referring to is losing a piece of fuel grain out the back end. You remember?
Yeah, I do remember. Uh-huh.
Okay, well, that's what's happening. A piece of fuel let go. Okay?
Right.
So these are the challenges. Now, if you have higher regression fuels, you can get creative and do a lot of cool stuff, then you can overcome some of these things, and you can put mechanical things in there to help strengthen the fuel grain. But there's always compromises. So without getting any technical than this, David, I've probably done got everybody falling asleep at home, but that's in a nutshell. Those, yes, it is definitely gets more challenging as they get bigger. Boy, is that a long answer. Sorry.
So there's always trades and compromises you're going to make. So you probably didn't learn this stuff in when you were in college. How do you pick it up? Is this mostly on-the-job training, being around other people, reading books and papers? How do you get your expertise?
It's reading, it's working with the data, it's working with the hardware, it's anchoring your models that you generate yourself and your team generates, it's taking apart not two, three, or four rocket engines, it's hundreds of test firings under your belt, it's just understanding the physics, it's reading lots of AIAA papers, it's just a lot of stuff, it's a lot of boots on the ground training, and you gotta always question the whys. Why does this do what it does, and what are the driving physics, what are the variables, and I'm just I'm a kind of guy, I'm very intuitive about things, and I really want to know the whys. And I don't, and my memory's pretty good, so I just stew on things, and you know, it just kind of, it just clicks, you know. I don't know. You know, we're all wired different. I don't know.
If you were in graduate school today, would this stuff be taught today, or is graduate school that much different from when you were in school?
I doubt it. You know, the practical issues of any of these systems are not ever taught that often. You know, you have these various factions of people that are enamored by certain areas. You'll have the liquid engine guys that go have their AIAA little groups, and they're this, that's, the liquids are the only answer. They are the answer to everyone's problems forever, and we know that because we're smart guys. Then you got the hybrid groups that are doing the same thing, and there's no other answer. They're, you know, and then the solid guys, they're over there and they've got a similar testimony. It's really, and I've always had a perspective of, I kind of try to go up to 100,000 feet and look down, and I feel like there's not always a single solution and answer. And people that are very well respected in this field, there's a couple of people, I won't call out by names, but they share that sentiment, who have lots of hardware testing with hybrids, big hybrids, and others. They share my sentiment. They agree that people are, and most of the people who have these views haven't done much real work in the world of testing. So it's easy for them to be in the theoretical world and not be able to be taught all the real world problems with all their solutions that they're teaching in class.
So what?
Yeah, and they never see this stuff on it. When they're test firing with their students a 300 or 500 pound thrust engine, they never see any of this stuff. They're never going to identify the real issues with these bigger systems, and they will argue with you to the death that that's just the best answer, hands down.
So if you,
go ahead.
Well, if you were asked to give the commencement address to the aerospace engineering class over there at the university in Huntsville, what would you tell them to do, career advice wise, or once they walk out of school and they're entering the real world?
Well, my advice has been from the beginning for any of these students, and I do get out and give talks because they invite me in, and I tell them, you guys, you got to get your boots on the ground. You guys need to get out and build stuff, get your hands dirty, because the world is never, ever what you think. I said the amount of money out there to do any project and the patience for you to have success is waning, and it's almost nil. I said, so if you don't know what you're doing out of the box as soon as you graduate and get in and plugged in the right area, I said, what will happen is you'll have a year or two to do something sometimes, and if you don't produce some tangible results, they will pull your money or the program will go away and things like that. I said, you guys, if you want a discriminator, you better start learning how the real world works, and you better be able to prototype quickly, learn something, make your bosses look good, give them data, give them pictures, and build yourself programs with substance. And otherwise, you'll be out here, you'll do good to finish one or two programs before you retire and are pulling around a golf cart or something. And I said, that would be very unfortunate. You'll be a cube person, you know, spanking a computer all day, things like that. You know, these kids, they get it. I said, get involved in the robot program. Get involved in the student launch initiative. Get involved. I said, go to the smaller companies and where you can actually do stuff. And, you know, so that's what I tell them.
You've done some work with Bigelow Aerospace, right?
Right.
Can you talk about any of that?
Yeah, Bigelow Aerospace is the coolest customer we got out there, in my opinion. If there is ever a customer that's like a James Bond movie, it would be Bigelow. Robert Bigelow's operations out there have got the cool factor pegging the meter, man. I mean, it is. And I don't know if you've been out there, but...
Yeah, many times I'm trying to get Bob back on the show.
Okay.
But hard to do.
Bob is he's a good guy, I tell you. He's a great American in terms of his commitment to the space program and his focus to get this thing done, get some of these Sun Dancers on orbit and grow this into being something really spectacular is really a testimony to his vision there. And so basically, for him, we did his forward propulsion system for his Sun Dancer, and we built. In fact, I committed to Bob that I would leave my job as president full time and work as basically a chief engineer, program manager, at least through the engine development. So I actually led that those thruster development, that architecture. And I brought in a good guy named Mark Fisher, who spent 15 years out at Marshall, who's a X-34 program manager for a while, and worked fast track. It was really interesting. This guy really understood the AF9100 process. He understood manned flight readiness and pushing hardware through all the processes that were so important to qualifying hardware. But he was, he kind of looked at that Bigelow program. He's like, oh, yeah, you guys over there on the commercial front, yeah, good luck with that. But when he got involved in that program, and 18 months later, he delivered that hardware to Mr. Bigelow, his AF9100 certified hardware. He was so excited about what a small team of commercially minded, unobscured people could do. He's a convert, and I'll tell you, he's been in the hardware ever since, working the peroxide warm gas stuff. He runs the department. Basically, he runs the space group here, not the space group. He actually runs the propulsion division of the space group. But so Bigelow allowed us to get certified, and it was not a requirement the Bigelow and them put on us. They certainly needed quality, but we went ahead and went for the full certification, and they still got a great value. And in fact, they were really, really pleased to the point where they said, this is the criteria we're going to put on our other vendors for as far as the rating, the man rating. And it was just a win-win. I mean, we've had a lot of people contact us about that, the fact that it runs off the wastewater byproducts, that hydrogen-oxygen engine. They had us in Popular Mechanics about 2 months ago in an article. I think Alabama Technology Magazine, they're getting ready to do an article with us on that. I mean, it's just been a really neat program. The fact that we've got this in space inflatable and we're reclaiming things. It's been cool.
My experience is of course limited and very different, but he's one of the most enjoyable interviews I ever made. Touring his plant when I did was amazing. And he is the only guy, and I've tried several, that has a payload of mine on orbit, on Genesis 2. He's got my dog's ashes up there. And I've tried lots and lots of ways. My dog and my mom have flown suborbitally out of Spaceport America successfully. But Bigelow's the only one who has gotten to orbit. He got it on the first try, obviously, with Genesis 2, and they're still up there. So to me, the guy can do no wrong.
Wow.
So I get to see Biscuit occasionally as he passes overhead wherever I happen to be. I track the satellite. Not the satellite, but Genesis 2. Wow. But I think he's really revolutionary, and he's just an amazing guy. And, boy, I sure hope he's... he's going to be up there. He says they hope to fly around 2014, 2015 when he made his talk at the AIAA commercial space section. But, of course, he's 100% dependent upon a ride. So, right. You know, that may
it
be what...
It's interesting, though, you know, the fact that him and Boeing have went and teamed up.
Yeah,
and,
he's...
Working the capsule stuff, and now their space adventure coming in there, and
absolutely,
and getting an agreement with Boeing, it's really exciting.
Very exciting, and I think his whole venture is really exciting. And yeah, I agree with you. I think he's a great guy. And then you told me you have a new rocket belt that you've been playing and flying with that runs on water, right?
Yeah. I wish I could claim it was my idea, but it ain't. I saw a guy on YouTube that was selling it's rocket belt over in Europe somewhere that it looked like it ran, basically, if you could imagine a jet ski out there in the water with a big water hose coming off the back of it, 30, 40 feet long, going to a backpack. And actually diverting that water to the right and left of you through nozzles and flying. That's kind of what he did. But these things were selling for like $130,000. And I thought, well, nobody I know is going to go buy that. But I did think, you know, I think I could build something like that from Home Depot, maybe with less, hopefully maybe $1,000 or less. So what I did is I went down and I told my daughter we'd seen the Iron Man movie, Iron Man 2.
Right.
And actually, we'd seen Iron Man 1, 2 before. And I thought, you know, we're going to build one of those, and we're going to build it. We're going to go to Home Depot, and I bought foam, and we carved it and fiberglassed it, and we bought PVC and made some thrust bearings for it, and we basically made a T, big 5-inch T, at our back behind us where it could swivel, and to the right and left we sweep some elbows, and you had handles where you could do pitch and yaw with these handles, and basically we built a belt and we got her flying it. In fact, she's going to be there's an article on some of that stuff. It's going to be in the next Make magazine. And Joe, I got an email today that's going to be featured on Joe Genius. Will show on YouTube that's out there. And yeah, but she's flying it, and I was a little heavy for this version, but it was really neat. She was controlling it and flying it above the lake, and it's just it was the most exciting thing I've done in a long time to watch my kid flying.
How high does it take her, or what does it do?
You know, I was keeping her feet up. I got her up to about 6 feet above the water, but I was limiting that by the throttle, and I just didn't want to see her, you know, get hurt or anything. So I was just keeping her down near the surface of the water, and it's really easy to control the throttle with the jet ski. So, heck, it really, really worked really good. And the Make magazine folks, they thought it'd be neat, that and a couple other things like the rocket truck and stuff. They just kind of covering a little bit of wacky stuff. So they saw me at a space conference and asked me if they could do something on it. So that's going to be out. So that's it's different, but I'll tell you, I've been wanting to fly something, even the bikes and all that wacky stuff. But this one is, tell you, we're way down the country. We got a little place on the lake that we go weekends, and I'll tell you, those little old country boys were all running down the bank, and when my daughter was up above that water, they were just grinning ear to ear, couldn't believe. They're like, "Where'd you get that? Where'd you get that?" And they were ready to go buy one, and it was just very surreal. I can assure you, nobody on that lake has been walking on water anytime.
This is the daughter I interviewed at ISDC in Washington, D.C., right?
Yeah, she was light enough to get her up. I tried. It got close, but it was I was a little heavy. So
she's about right.
Get with PVC, by the way. You can't pick the sizes, but you're limited. I tried to make it work with what we found local. Now I'm building one with aluminum pipe. A little more expensive, but it's going to allow be able to lift up a good 250-pound person, which I'm like 190.
Well, it'll lift me then if I quit eating.
All right. We'll get you up next time you're in Alabama.
Well, you know, there's a couple of conferences coming up in Huntsville that I'd like to go. The Advanced Propulsion, what do they call it? I forget the name of it, but it's the Legacy.
We just had the Joint Propulsion Conference.
No, this is by this used to be the group out of the University of New Mexico, and it's now something different, and I can't remember the name of it all of a sudden.
We just had the
STAFE or something like that.
What is it?
STAFE or something like that. SPECIF. The SPECIF conference is coming back to Huntsville. It was there 2 years ago. And I think ISDC is they're going back to Johns Hopkins, I think. ISDC is going to be in Huntsville. Yeah, I think ISDC is coming to Huntsville.
Yeah, that'll be good. We're excited about that. There's a few. Yeah, it's Huntsville. Every now and then we get some pretty good stuff. The Joint Propulsion was in Nashville this year, and then of course the Space and Missile Defense Conference is huge every year. This year was really big here in Huntsville, so that's something that's really good to get out to if you ever want to see the latest in the missile defense program stuff.
Are you going to be at the Personal Spaceflight Symposium in Las Cruces?
Yep, I'll be out there, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to be there for the inauguration of the
runway.
And I'm looking forward to talking about, all the trials and tribulations of space businesses and all that good stuff.
So we're pretty much near the end of the show. What should I have asked you to talk about that you want to talk about that we did not cover?
I don't know. I just I can't think of anything. You know, I just appreciate you inviting me on. I want to just tell everybody we're still working hard, and Orion's team is they're still working really hard here at Dynetics, and those guys are really settling in, and we're bringing in a lot of new good work, and we're working, you know, all kind of launch vehicle stuff, and we're working lander stuff, and we're working just a lot of green propellants and even defense stuff. So it's just there's a lot of cool stuff going on. So when you're in a mid-tier size company, and Dynetics is 1,300 people, that's the new direction a lot of the big government's wanting to move. They're wanting to get away from the huge primes and move, they're saying, down to the mid-tier level companies, because this is where the stuff gets done. You got to remember, big companies have been going to the mid-tier guys anyways. So now the government's saying, hey, we're going to start going straight to the mid-tier. So that's good. That's great. That's what we want to do. We want to build stuff, and that's what Dynetics is going to do, and we're positioned well to do that here in Huntsville. And you're going to see a lot of commitment from us. And it'll be more clear in the next few weeks that we are very committed to doing some stuff.
Is Dynetics hiring?
They have been on some fronts as we win different contracts. You know, a while back they won a big MIT thing. It was about a $300 million deal with NASA to support some computer support stuff and whatnot. But it's hit and miss. Right now we do have some openings at various marketing levels and other places, but I don't know all the recs that are out right now. It's really comes and goes, so you just need to stay tuned.
Okay. If people want to ask you a question or comment, do you give out an email address, or you want me to filter it for you?
Sure, they can. They've got something out there. They can shoot it to, I'll tell you what, just shoot it to janet.feltz, F-E-L-T-S. At Dynetics, Dynetics, .com.
She'll love you for that, right?
she's a very good communications person. We worked a lot of good stuff here together, and she will, anything relating to employment or something like that, she'll know where that goes. And if it's something technical and I need to help out there, she'll shoot it over here. So it's just a good way to make sure that Tim doesn't drop the ball.
Okay, Tim, look, it's been a pleasure. I'm going to unfortunately be teaching in North Dakota instead of going to Las Cruces. I'm kind of disappointed at that. But I'm sure our paths will cross soon, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And listeners, on Sunday, we're going to talk about the book Platinum Moon. The author, Bill White, is with us. You don't want to miss that show. Thank you all for listening to Tim Pickens and myself on this Friday Space Show program.